What evidence is there that the removal of Ukrainian President Yanukovych from power 1 year ago was indeed a foreign-sponsored coup d'etat and not the result of a corrupt leader trying to escape the wrath of freedom-loving Ukrainians demanding justice? Are the US and NATO acting in response to Russian-backed aggression, or is it the other way around? How much clout did the minority faction of neo-Nazis have in the events that precipitated regime change in Kiev? What is motivating the neocon hawks in Washington to push President Obama toward ever more reckless and aggressive postures toward the Kremlin? And what does the recent victory by rebel forces in Debaltseve portend for the outcome of this conflict? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, the week marking the one-year anniversary of the turbulent events that saw a democratically elected Ukrainian president removed from power, we'll hear an analysis of the background of the current conflict from investigative journalist Robert Perry, and we'll hear an assessment of the current geopolitical situation with Rick Rozoff, manager of the Stop NATO listserv. On this week's program, Ukraine, 1 year after the coup. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 20th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Why has the U.S. Air Force not been able to wipe out the Islamic State, which at the outset was largely equipped with conventional small arms, not to mention state-of-the-art Toyota pickup trucks? From the very outset, this air campaign has not been directed against ISIS. The evidence confirms that the Islamic State is not the target. The air raids are intended to destroy the economic infrastructure of Iraq and Syria. If they had wanted to eliminate the Islamic State brigades, they could have carpet-bombed their convoys of Toyota pickup trucks when they crossed the desert from Syria into Iraq in June. That was from the article, Obama's Fake War Against the Islamic State, ISIS. The Islamic State is protected by the U.S. and its allies, by Professor Michel Chosadovsky, posted February 19th. About 15 minutes before the confab began, Varoufakis was given a draft communique outlining the provisions of the proposed loan extension. He was pleasantly surprised to find that the document met all his requirements, and so he was prepared to sign it. As it happens, the final copy was just a rehash of the same agreement that Varoufakis has rejected from the onset. But their trickery and bullying hasn't worked, mainly because Varoufakis is too smart for them. And he's too charismatic and talented, too, which is a problem for the EU bigwigs who resent the fact that this upstart Marxist academic has captured the imaginations of people around the world, upsetting their little plan to perpetuate Greece's six-year-long depression. That was from the article, Iron Man Varoufakis' Revolutionary Plan for Europe, Don't Tell Anyone in Berlin, by Mike Whitney, posted February 19th, originally appearing at Counterpunch. I must say that I find the decision to ban Reverend Sizer from all social media a little difficult to understand, and I find it an extremely inconsistent approach by the Church of England, especially following so closely on the heels of the Charlie Hebdo event in Paris. Why has the Church of England not also publicly condemned the allegations by our government officials and mainstream media about alleged Muslim involvement in 9/11? These are allegations that have been made with absolutely no evidence to support them. Instead of banning your staff from attempting to ask questions about who was really responsible for 9/11, the Church of England should instead be supporting the hundreds of thousands of courageous and peace-loving individuals around the world who have been campaigning tirelessly for new investigations into what really happened on that day of 9/11 and exactly who was involved. Because the one thing that is absolutely certain about 9/11 is that we have not been told the truth by our governments and our military officials. That was from the article, Backlash by Church of England, Vicar Banned from Social Media for Endorsing 9/11 Truth, Open Letter to the Bishop of Guildford, by Peter Drew, posted February 19th. Charges of aggression and crime against Russia and Putin are daily proclaimed with no evidence, but together provide a pretext for why Russia must be stopped and the U.S.-led West Ukraine regime armed with U.S. weapons to teach Putin a lesson. The known $5 billion spent on political destabilization of Ukraine in recent years, the covert special forces, and the direct financing and orchestration of the overtly fascist coup leaders all disappear into the anti-Putin Russia propaganda field. The February 15th truce has been made because the eastern Ukraine resistance and forces have effectively pushed the Kiev forces, fascist militias, and mercenaries out of the Donbass-Donetsk region. No sooner was the truce signed than all onus was put on Russia to sustain it, with none evident on Kiev or its U.S. master. Is it just another pause before more weapons, special forces, and advisors come in to prop up the U.S.-constructed coup state in Kiev? That was from the article, Ukraine, America's Lebensraum. Is Washington preparing to wage war on Russia? Truce on the first anniversary of the U.S.-led coup, by Professor John McMurtry, posted February 18th. Barack Obama is the first ever U.S. president to install a Nazi, i.e. racist fascist, regime anywhere in Europe. In fact, if one doesn't count Eisenhower's 1954 overthrow of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala and replacement of him by a fascist regime as having installed a Nazi regime there, which one might if one considers the subsequent widespread slaughter there of the native population to have been genocidal or an ethnic cleansing, then Obama is the first ever outright Nazi U.S. president, the first one who has installed a Nazi, i.e. racist fascist, regime anywhere. When Obama set up a violent coup that in February 2014 overthrew the democratically elected president of Ukraine and replaced him with a racist fascist anti-Russian regime and with a follow-on ethnic cleansing program to eliminate the residents in the portion of Ukraine that had voted 90% for the man whom Obama had just overthrown, Russian public opinion turned sharply against the United States. Russians were shocked to find that the nation that Democratic President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had led in a war against Nazis and other fascists had now become, under Democratic President Barack Obama, a nation that instead sponsored a Nazi coup in Ukraine so as to place NATO missiles near Moscow, even worse than President Eisenhower, who at least had an excuse that he was anti-communist. Americans have no reason other than American media propaganda and brainwashing to fear Vladimir Putin, but plenty of reason to fear Barack Obama. He's goading Putin into another arms race and weapons buildup toward a possible nuclear war. That was from the article, America Threatens to Wage War on Russia. U.S. Public is Being Prepped to Hate Russians and to Fear Russia, by Eric Zeus, posted February 18th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The week of February 20th marks the anniversary of the removal of Viktor Yanukovych from power. History records that this was the culmination of a populist uprising called the Euromaidan, which took hold in late 2013 when the Ukrainian president, abandoned an agreement with the European Union in favor of a treaty and multi-billion-dollar loan with Russia. Violent clashes between Maidan protesters and police erupted after February 18th. On February 21st, a compromise deal was arrived at between opposition members and Yanukovych, but this deal was rejected by the protesters. Shortly thereafter, the Maidan protesters took over government buildings. The president fled, and the remaining representatives in the Verkhovna Rada, the Ukrainian parliament, proceeded with an unconstitutional impeachment of the leader. A new interim government was instituted, and areas of Ukraine to the east and south commenced efforts to separate from the new Kiev regime, leading to the present conflict. To get a better understanding of what has happened in Ukraine, of who all the players are, and the role played by Russia and NATO, we are joined by Robert Perry. Robert Perry is an investigative journalist whose career spans four decades. He broke many of the Iran-Contra stories for the Associated Press and Newsweek in the 1980s. He's an editor and co-founder of Consortium News, the first investigative news magazine to appear on the internet. He's written extensively on the crisis in Ukraine and joins us right now by phone. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Perry.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so this week marks the anniversary of what's been called the Ukrainian Revolution. You and other writers on the outside of mainstream opinion have called it a coup enacted by neo-Nazis. What are some of the key details of that event being ignored or distorted by the mainstream Western media that lead you to that description of the event?
Well, it was pretty obviously a coup by any stretch of the imagination. There was an elected president in power, Viktor Yanukovych. He was removed in an unconstitutional manner. The way this evolved was in 2013 there had been an effort which Yanukovych was part of to develop an association agreement with the European Union. In some ways, and this is even the view of Der Spiegel, the EU overplayed its hand, as did Chancellor Merkel of Germany. When it got to November of 2013, when Merkel was expecting Yanukovych to sign the agreement, Yanukovych was given a report from his economic experts in Kiev that the cost of cutting off their business ties to Russia would be $160 billion, and that was quite a sticker shock, and he asked for more time to consider this and to figure out some way to develop a healthier approach for his country. And that was seized upon by people who were much more eager to develop ties with Europe, particularly the Western Ukrainians. There were mass demonstrations at the Maidan. Some of the far-right elements that have always had a strong foothold in Western Ukraine, especially around the city of Lviv, began organizing forces of 100 men each. They called them SOTINs, and they would send these groups by bus into Kiev, and they provided the muscle, in effect, for the Maidan demonstrations, which got more and more violent. Eventually, the violence included throwing firebombs at police, and these clashes got nastier and nastier. And then on February 20th of last year, there was mysterious sniper fire, which killed some police and also some demonstrators. And that led to a further deterioration of the situation and more fighting and more violence and more killing. Then on February 21st, Yanukovych essentially conceded to many of the points of the Maidan demonstrators. He agreed to reduce his powers. He agreed to hold early elections so he could be voted out of office. Many people who've dealt with him felt he was actually hoping to get voted out of office because he'd lost control of the situation and didn't know what to do. But then on February 22nd, some of these right-wing elements, when the police withdrew from the area, they attacked the presidential buildings and seized them, and Yanukovych's people fled for their lives, And in that chaotic situation, the Western governments, in many ways, including the United States, urged the parliament to act, and to they threw Yanukovych out, not following the constitutional procedures, and replaced him. It was, in every sense, a coup d'etat. Similar to what you might have seen, say, in Iran in 53 or Guatemala in 54, you go through all the sort of famous coup d'etats. This was not dissimilar. There was, of course, a desire by basically the U.S. government and the mainstream press, the New York Times, Washington Post, and many others, had really sided with the Maidan demonstrators. We know, for instance, that there was a phone call between Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and the ambassador the U.S. ambassador in Kiev, Jeffrey Pyatt, where they discussed who the new leadership should be. This was in early February, Ms. Nuland favored Arseniy Yatsenyuk. She said Yats is the guy. They discussed how to midwife this thing, and so you even have this evidence of the United States working behind the scenes to remove Yanukovych and put in a new regime. It was regime change, in effect. So I don't know, if one looks at this from any objective standpoint, it was quite clearly a coup d'etat. And it really has been sort of a bizarre element of this whole entirely bizarre way this story has been handled for the past year, that the mainstream American press has not approached this objectively, has not approached it in any kind of honest way. If you read the New York Times and the Washington Post and others, they have been on the side of the Maidan demonstrators, and secondly, the government that overthrew Yanukovych. We are seeing, as much as I've ever seen it before, a groupthink in the Western press, in the American press in particular, dissimilar in some ways to the groupthink that preceded the Iraq War, when many of the same newspapers and editors and writers had agreed that there was no question that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and was about to give them to al-Qaeda. And even though that turned out to be completely false, as we've learned later, as the cost of the U.S. being involved in a very misguided war that continues to wreak havoc in the region, but there were very few people, virtually except maybe one or two people, who paid any kind of price. There was almost no accountability. And many of the same people like Fred Hyatt, the editorial page editor of the Washington Post, is the same guy. He's still in the same job. He never got fired for his misreporting and miswriting about about Iraq. So there he is. So he's back now, carrying the neocon torch on Ukraine. So that's what sort of happened. A lot has been followed, but really the big lie that started this whole thing in many ways was this notion that Putin had instigated this crisis, when it's quite clear that he didn't. It was instigated by the EU and its handling of the association agreement, followed by the efforts by people like Victoria Nuland and others to heat the crisis up. None of that involved Putin. He was busy with his Olympics in Sochi at the time. So it's kind of been a bizarre watching how this has been handled. It's kind of almost, I've been in Washington for a very long time, so I've seen a lot of this. But this one sort of takes the cake in terms of false claims. There's no evidence that Putin tried to overthrow Yanukovych. In fact, he was trying to support Yanukovych.
There was an agreement that he was involved in brokering, that, as you mentioned, I mean, that there were all the conditions for the elections by no later than December, but also the withdrawal of the police forces,
right,
and that everybody agreed to.
Right.
And then it was the mob, I guess, or the Maidan protesters who rejected it.
At that time, the Maidan, there were legitimate protesters at the Maidan. Some people estimate that 70% were just Ukrainians who wanted to see changes in their government, which is certainly understandable. And many of them were hoping that they would get visa-free travel to Europe. They wouldn't have to go through the process they have to go through because many of them wanted to work elsewhere. All that's understandable. But about 30% or so of the protesters, as this thing evolved, were these hardline Ukrainian nationalists. Some of them were outright neo-Nazis, who became the muscle of the Maidan. They this fellow Perevuy, who is a neo-Nazi. He was the commander of the Maidan. He later became, under the new government, the head of their national security. So you had this very violent group that that exploited the situation for their own ends and their own desires to essentially make Ukraine more of a European country, or in some cases, some of them were looking to some kind of Ukrainian racial purity. They do not like the ethnic Russians who dominate the East and the South. This has been a split that Ukraine's had for decades, generations. And what happened was that these divisions were made worse, exacerbated by efforts by outsiders in some cases to take advantage of this crisis, and included the U.S. government, including the State Department. Apparently saw something to gain here.
You and other writers commenting on media coverage have commented on the double standard, where they talk about the Crimean withdrawal or the Crimean referendum as being illegitimate, and yet here you have this handover to replacement of Yanukovych by this by a process that went against their own constitution, and they didn't even have the requisite number of people present in the parliament in the Rada to enact that properly, and yet that was considered legitimate.
Right. There was expediency when it came to getting rid of Yanukovych that violated the constitution of Ukraine. So there are procedures for impeaching a president. They were not followed. There was simply a declaration that the seat was vacant and they put somebody else in it. Then when it came to the issue of Crimea, what you saw basically was after this new regime took over, many of the people who had voted for Yanukovych, understandably, were upset. If you could imagine in the United States, if part of our population had successfully elected a president and then some other group comes in and throws him out, the people who'd voted for him would feel disenfranchised. That's how they felt. Plus, there were steps being taken against the Russians, the ethnic Russians in the East. There was, a misguided effort by the Rada to the parliament to strip Russian as an official language. So there were reasons why there was concern in places like Crimea and in the East against what was happening. They saw the guy they'd voted for thrown out, and some new guys take over who weren't very friendly. So then you had the Crimeans, first through their parliament and then through the referendum that was set up, saying, "We want out of this. We don't." And there were other practical reasons too. The Russians pay a larger pension. The pensions in Ukraine were rather meager. So there were practical reasons too why people voted 90-some percent to leave Ukraine and rejoin Russia, where they'd had these historical ties. But that was then deemed a violation of the Constitution, the same Constitution that didn't matter much when Yanukovych was being thrown out. So yeah, there were double standards. And everything was just as sort of whatever was convenient to make the sort of political argument in Washington was embraced, rather than applying some kind of common standard to this. And also, you have to remember that the United States has often supported referenda by different ethnic and national subnational groups to declare their independence. We supported
Kosovo
recently in South Sudan. We supported it in Kosovo. This is not unheard of. It's actually a pretty common process in the world to have different parts of a country break off if there are in cases where, especially when there are extreme cases like a civil war.
Have you heard much about, like, in the wake of the events of February 21st, 22nd, reports of from the people who were left behind? I mean, if Yanukovych was fleeing for his life, there was clearly a sense of intimidation. I mean, did you hear any feedback from any of the people in the Rada about being like voting under duress or any descriptions along those lines?
Sure, there were people being threatened. There were people being beaten up. There were some parliamentarians literally tossed into big garbage dumps. It was a very brutal situation. And now what we're seeing in this new supposedly democratic regime, we're seeing news organizations that don't toe the line or allow, say, someone who favors the Eastern Ukrainians on. These stations are being threatened with being shut down. We've seen now there's a bill that's been introduced to imprison people for 5 years if they even suggest that there's not Russian aggression. So what we're seeing is not this perfect example of democracy that we've been led to believe. And also the idea that this is a reform government is also fraudulent. One of the first things that this new government did is they removed the governors of the various provinces and put their own people in, and they even put in oligarchs. These are some of the rich guys who had stolen money after the end of the Soviet Union. They people who had cleaned up to the disadvantage of the average Ukrainian who's been left essentially in poverty. Some of these oligarchs were then appointed themselves as governors. Kolomovsky, one of the more thuggish oligarchs, was given his own province to run. So you're not seeing this idea of reform. A piece I wrote just yesterday about the new finance minister, Natalie Jaureska, and her work before she became suddenly a Ukrainian citizen in December and then finance minister. She'd been a former U.S. diplomat who had been put in charge of a $150 million U.S. taxpayer fund that was supposedly to do investments in Ukraine. And there are all kinds of insider deals and irregularities in that fund, which I describe in this article. And when her ex-husband had tried to blow the whistle on some of these irregularities, she took him to court in Delaware, under claiming he was violating some confidentiality agreement, and silenced him. And if you read the court record, they basically also got all the details redacted, so the American people can't see what's going on here. So this idea that this is now in the hands of some great reformers who are bringing clean business and government to Ukraine is another one of the myths that we've been sort of fed. Yes, Ukraine has suffered from serious corruption since the beginning of this new era in 1991-92, but it's not one-sided. It wasn't just Yanukovych who was corrupt. It was the other side as well. And in fact, some of the people that have been, as I say, moved up in the government are in some ways more corrupt than some of the folks who had been there before. So I don't think we're not seeing reform in any way, shape, or form. We're seeing more repression. We're seeing a clampdown on freedom of speech. We're seeing some of these self-interested parties put in positions of power where they control these resources. And obviously they'll be handling the $17.5 billion or whatever the IMF is planning to give them.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. In your writing, you've talked about the neocons in the State Department and that Putin represents something particularly abominable for them. Could you just address that issue, that where the neocons' motivation is here?
Well, sure. Basically, if you go back to the beginning of the Obama administration, Obama, I would sort of say he's essentially a closet realist, and a realist in the sense that he wanted to sort of work with the various leaders of the world, even if he didn't like them particularly, to see if he could ease some of the conflicts. Remember, he took over in 2009 when the U.S. was at war in Iraq, at war in Afghanistan, and doing wars in a lot of places. And he really, I think, did want to see if he could ratchet that down, not end it necessarily, but ratchet it down, make it less violent, partly because of the expense of it and partly because of just the chaos that was being spread around the world. But Obama did not really take control of his own foreign policy. He opted for what was then known as the team of rivals, if you remember. And he left Robert Gates, Bush's defense secretary in at the Pentagon. He left the high command pretty much in place, people like General David Petraeus. He appointed Hillary Clinton, who was sort of a neocon light, a sort of a hawkish Democrat, to be Secretary of State. And those forces generally allied themselves against Obama's efforts to sort of to take the off ramp on some of these conflicts. For instance, they pressured him in 2009 to escalate the war in Afghanistan. Obama felt he'd been sort of blindsided by that. He just didn't realize how power worked, I guess, in Washington, how powerful these folks could be. And plus, you had in official Washington, you have the major news organizations. The Washington Post is a neoconservative publication at this point. The think tanks are dominated by neoconservatives. Even things like the Brookings Institution has key neocons all in positions, Council on Foreign Relations as well. So you have even some of the more centrist think tanks have moved to the neocon camp. And you also have some of the more aggressive, what were known as liberal interventionists, people like Samantha Power, pushing for policies very much in line with what the neocons want. That is to intervene aggressively in some of these conflicts around the world. So Obama surrounded himself with people that really weren't on the same page with him in many ways. But he tried to finesse it, and occasionally he would when things got to the edge of the cliff, he tried to pull it back from the cliff. And we saw what happened in Syria in 2013, which is crucial to this. And that is that the neocons had wanted regime change in Syria for a long time. It was on their list. They had a menu which included Iraq. There was going to be Syria. There's going to be Iran. Those were the main three countries targeted for regime change under the neocon scheme that was played out a decade ago with not very much success in Iraq. But in 2013, there was a mysterious sarin attack on August 21st, 2013. It was immediately blamed on the Assad government, although people inside the U.S. intelligence community did not really go along with that, had real doubts about who had done it. But there was this rush to judgment, and the neocons thought they were going to have their war. The U.S. was very close to bombing the Assad's military, and it got to the edge of the cliff. And Obama, at the last minute, pulled back. He then worked with Putin to arrange a diplomatic solution, which was to gets Assad to surrender all his chemical weapons, even though Assad kept saying he had nothing to do with the sarin attack. He did give up his chemical weapons. And that infuriated the neocons, who had really been counting on the U.S. bombing Assad. So you start seeing the animosity toward Putin ratcheting up from that point. Putin also helped Obama later in 2013 get a deal with Iran to constrain its nuclear program, another position the neoconservatives hated because they wanted to bomb Iran. You remember McCain talking about bomb Iran.
Yeah.
So Putin was kind of had become a real bête noire to them for his help, his work with Obama in diffusing some of these crises. So what we start seeing is comments like from Carl Gershman, the president of the National Endowment for Democracy, a leading neocon in Washington, taking to the pages of the Washington Post to say, Ukraine's the biggest prize, but beyond that, we can make Putin end up on the wrong side of internally as well as externally. In other words, regime change became not just the goal in Ukraine, but also in Moscow. and that became the new neoconservative goal. And you saw it play out at the end of 2013 and early 2014 in Ukraine with the ouster of Yanukovych. And you're now seeing it, and people are now talking much more about the idea of how to destabilize Russia, using the sanctions to make their economy scream, try to get these NGOs and other groups that are funded by American money in various ways, either through a Soros operation or through the National Endowment for Democracy, to get them to sort of undermine Putin internally and maybe have a Maidan in the Red Square. I mean, that's what they're kind of thinking about now, and they're thinking in terms of moving it to the next level, which is to take Putin out. But typically of the neoconservatives, and we've seen it everywhere they've touched, they may have these ideas in their heads about how neatly all this is going to work, as we saw with Iraq. It doesn't always work that way in real life. In fact, it rarely works that way in real life. And that's so what we've ended up seeing is chaos being spread. Yes, maybe it was Saddam Hussein was a bad guy, but he was sort of holding his country together. Gaddafi may have been a bad guy, but he was holding Libya together. You sort of take those people out, and what you end up with are a lot of other really bad guys stepping in. And that's sort of what the neocons don't seem to be ever able to understand. So they end up spreading disorder and chaos, and we've seen it again in Ukraine. The thing with Ukraine, the key point I think to understand, was this was a very manageable political issue. The pace for which the Ukrainians would begin to open up to the European Union while still trying to manage to maintain economic ties with Russia, that should not have been the kind of issue that leads to what's happened. This was something that politically systems handle. And instead of that, it was pushed to this next level of a coup d'etat, which then led to a civil war, which has now led to the United States and Russia, you know, almost facing themselves each other down militarily. Both sides, by the way, have lots of nuclear weapons. So the price, the risks involved with Ukraine are so high, they're literally existential. But the issue was rather minor. The pace with which Ukraine would open up economically to the EU and while still trying to maintain relations with Russia, that should not have been something that leads to the kind of destruction we've seen across Ukraine and the kind of international crisis that's been left behind. This is like one of the ultimate neoconservative efforts to think they're going to do something simple. They're going to just go in there, do regime change, put some new people in. But in the real world, people get angry. They feel they're being disenfranchised. They take up arms. And then one side does something to the other side. And before you know it, a lot of people are dead, and things are spinning out of control. And this has been typical of how the neoconservatives have handled everything since they developed their powerful positions in Washington, beginning in the 1980s and continuing to today.
The neocons, are they such prisoners of their particular mentality that there's no choice but to somehow either suppress them or, you know, keep escalating to the point where we're in a nuclear confrontation?
Well, I've sometimes compared it to that children's ditty about the little old lady who swallowed the fly. You know, the neocons started with some rather modest thoughts, essentially around how to help Israel maintain its security, how to sort of put Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Hamas and in the Palestinian areas on the defensive. And then they thought, well, we'll go after some of the people who are sponsoring them, who are helping them. And so then they, you know, that's part of the thinking about taking out Saddam Hussein in Iraq and taking out the Assad regime in Syria and taking out the Iranians in the Iranian government in Tehran. So then if they move to that level, and that didn't work out too well. So they keep moving to the next level. And when the Syrian thing did not work out as they wished in 2013, they were hoping that they could have bombed Assad's military, devastated it. And by the way, if that had happened, almost certainly the winners would not be some wonderful Syrian Democrats. They would have been either Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda affiliate, or the Islamic State. We would now, if that had happened, we very likely would have had a terrorist state controlled in Syria. So the neocons just don't think these things through very well. But then they got mad, so they took aim at Putin and they went after Ukraine, made that part of their regime change agenda now. And now they're talking about Moscow. Now, one has to wonder, though, what happens even if, say, they're successful, say they're able to create enough economic hardship in Russia. They can through sanctions and having, you know, the Saudis are helping out by keeping the oil prices down and causing, you know, undermining Putin somehow. The problem is that if you get rid of Putin, it doesn't mean you're going to have some, you know, wonderful guy taking over. It could be someone much worse than Putin. It could be one of these, you know, Russian nationalists we've seen. Some of them have, you know, gone and joined the fighting in Ukraine. Some of these are very extremist guys. So, I mean, you can end up with a much worse situation, a much more unstable situation. But this has become a thing with the neoconservatives. They have a great deal of influence in Washington, even under President Obama, who's not a neocon in my view. He's much more skeptical about those kinds of things. But he hasn't asserted his power very effectively in regards to them. And they do have this infrastructure now. They have a lot of think tanks. They have a lot of funding. Groups like the National Endowment for Democracy, run by neocon Carl Gershman, it's $100 million a year of taxpayers' money, which he can spread around. And so they have this ability to sustain themselves because they've got access to large sums of money, including taxpayer money. And that makes it hard to challenge them. Makes them determined to keep going because it's in a sense, it's kind of a business. So, and that's where we are, I think, as a nation. We're sort of up against this group that has amassed extraordinary influence and power in Washington that wants to get the United States involved in wars all over the place. If you listen to John McCain, who's a good example of a neocon, there's almost like no place he doesn't want to go to war. So that's the situation, I think. But on top of that, you've got a national news media now in the United States that won't behave professionally. I mean, there was a real quick story. There was a piece that the New York Times ran the other day, which I wrote about, and it was about they had a reporter in Mariupol, which is a port city in Ukraine. And it was basically a story about how the forces of civilization in Mariupol were standing up against these barbarians at the gate, these ethnic Russian rebels who were getting closer. And the great defenders of civilization in Mariupol was a group named as the Azov Battalion. And the New York Times does this long piece, you know, very detailed piece about the Azov Battalion, and they interview a couple of their people. They have this whole story. And they don't tell their readers who the Azov Battalion is. And it's been actually very well documented. The Azov Battalion is a neo-Nazi organization that operates under the swastika, that has SS symbols on their helmets. I mean, this isn't a secret. It's been reported by, it was even reported once by the New York Times. It's been reported by the London Telegraph. It's been reported by Foreign Policy Magazine. It's been reported by a lot of mainstream news organizations who the Azov Battalion is. But the New York Times had to choose not to inform its readers of this very salient fact about this group that they were hailing as sort of the defenders of the civilized world with the barbarians at the gate. The barbarians, the defenders of civilization, turned out to be the Nazis. And that's kind of a good story. But the New York Times doesn't want to tell that to their readers because it kind of destroys the narrative that they prefer, which is the white hats are in Western Ukraine and Kiev. Those are the white hats. The black hats are the Eastern Ukrainians, the ethnic Russians. They're just pawns of Moscow. And that's how they want to sell the story. But that's not professional. That's not what a professional journalist does. because frankly, it's a pretty good story. If you know, it's even kind of ironic, isn't it, that you think that that it's the neo-Nazis who are kind of defending what the New York Times presents as sort of the civilized world.
Well, Robert Perry, I want to thank you very much for sharing these thoughts with us on this very pivotal and important situation. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Okay, you're welcome.
We're now joined by Rick Rozoff. He is a geopolitical analyst and manager of the Stop NATO listserv. Thanks for joining us, Rick.
I'm glad to be back on your show, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Okay, now a ceasefire agreement was reached on February 11th in Minsk, Belarus, which went into force on the morning of February 15th. What can you tell us about those negotiations and the concessions that were made to achieve it?
I'm not privy to the inner workings of the meetings between the four heads of state, one of whom I would not even legitimately characterize as such. And I'm speaking, of course, in that latter instance of Petro Poroshenko, who I do not consider to be a legitimate head of state. And I'm rather surprised the Russian head of state decided to lower himself to the level of greeting him as a fellow head of state. But nevertheless, the Angela Merkel, François Hollande, Vladimir Putin and Petro Poroshenko met in Minsk, as you mentioned, the capital of Belarus, for the second such meeting in that city, ostensibly to secure another ceasefire in the ongoing war, and I want to underline that word, war in Ukraine, which is now, I believe, over 310 days old. And what we've seen immediately afterwards is an intensification of the fighting, particularly around the transit hub of what's known, at least in the Ukrainian version, as Debaltsev, with today a Ukrainian government or pro-government English language sources stating, perhaps unprecedented casualties suffered by Kiev's forces, by government forces in the past 24 hours. So, far from having secured a across-the-board ceasefire, what we've seen is an intensification of fighting in eastern Ukraine.
Well, let's talk about that crushing defeat then at the hands of the rebel self-defense forces. I mean, what are the implications for the outcome of this outcome for the civil war, in especially in the context of that ceasefire agreement?
That's arguably the most poignant question that could have been asked about it, and I think we have a couple of possibilities here. Of course, I'm in agreement with you, Michael. I think terms like annihilation are probably apt and accurate in summarizing the debacle. The complete defeat of Kiev's forces in the area. I would say, though, the self-defense forces in the Donbas region were humane enough to permit them to retreat with weapons. Which I think is maybe a little bit over-generous, particularly with the weapons. I think a precondition for allowing them to retreat in safety was to lay down all arms, because they'll be used again, of course. But short of them actually being physically annihilated, the military units were dispersed. They were apparently without food, without ammunition, and so forth for several days. They were not resupplied by the central government or pseudo-government in Kiev. So there are two distinct possibilities. One of them is this is seen throughout the rest of Ukraine as being a signal, demonstrable defeat for the Poroshenko-Yatsenyuk clique. And you begin to see dissension and dissatisfaction rise increasingly throughout the rest of Ukraine, perhaps to the point where it threatens the stability of the rump government in Kiev. That's number one. Number two, and what I think is equally likely and far more portentous, is that NATO, seeing its client regime suffering a fairly round defeat, decides to intervene. And that's something that I've been warning about for several days, is that the U.S. and in general NATO military buildup in Eastern Europe over the past year is such that those forces are and equipment are not being deployed, for symbolic purposes. They're being deployed for combat. And what a member of the Poroshenko bloc, that is the ruling bloc in the National Parliament of Ukraine, the Verkhovna Rada, a couple of days ago, yesterday as a matter of fact, called for NATO bombings in the Donbas against the self-defense forces. And that's a scenario that could evolve, you know, after the model of that in Libya in 2011 or Yugoslavia in 1999.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, is this another Libya? I mean, do you see boots on the ground or is it going to be mostly just an air campaign of some sort?
Well, you know, we've rarely seen NATO boots on the ground except after the conflict, after they've waged an air war, say, in Bosnia, 1994-1995, and then in Yugoslavia, Kosovo, in 1999. The one exception being in Afghanistan, of course, where up to over 150,000 troops were serving under NATO at peak strength. But again, this is post-invasion, as it were. You know, they, under a tenuous United Nations mandate, and of the International Security Assistance Force, NATO's been was involved in a 12-year war in Afghanistan, but came in after the war was supposedly won, if your listeners recollect. So, you know, rarely, NATO simply doesn't have, you know, the gumption, the courage to engage mano a mano with, you know, in any sort of symmetrical warfare. They prefer, of course, to bomb with cruise, Tomahawk cruise missiles and, you know, bombs dropped from 15,000, 20,000 feet in the air. That's their preferred method, and that's how they waged the wars they have waged against the Bosnian Serb Republic, against Serbia, Yugoslavia, against Libya, and, you know, the Afghanistan, again, being the exception. So I would expect it to be what you're indicating. That would be, you know, a series of so-called humanitarian bombings in the area of Donetsk, Lugansk, Mariupol, and other parts of the Donbas region.
Mm. Now, to what extent are the EU and the U.S. On the same page and united in the Ukraine project in terms of approach and intent? Are you seeing any important ruptures taking place politically, economically, or otherwise?
No. And this is something I've been arguing personally for since 1999, that there is no essential difference in the foreign policy orientation of European states gathered under the banner of NATO and the very same European states gathered under the banner of the European Union. To expect there to be any difference depending on what hat somebody wore on a given day is, I think, to be gullible. But I know this creeps up repeatedly. And, you know, as though François Hollande and Angela Merkel, the respectively heads of state of France and Germany, two of the NATO Quad countries, you know, the four major powers that really run NATO, the United States and Britain being the other two, to believe that when they, you know, travel as member leaders of EU countries are different than when they're leaders of NATO countries, you know, is patently absurd. And this entire Ukrainian crisis, the war began as a result of a European Union initiative, a so-called association agreement signed under the Eastern Partnership with the European Union, and when, or was to have been signed, rather, and when the government of now deposed President of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, you know, simply demurred, you know, simply postponed making a decision on that, then you know, the trouble began and the war ensued. So, and of course, we know the 1,001 links through by which the European Union and NATO are connected, you know, politically, ideologically, militarily, certainly under the Berlin Plus Agreement of the late 1990s and a number of other mechanisms. So this is sleight of hand, and it's meant to deceive people. And unfortunately, I think the Russian government is also in part responsible for covertly, you know, circulating rumors that the, you know, their policy is meant to split the EU from the United States. That's fine and good if there were no NATO. But as long as every European country, every single European country, except for Russia, which still belongs to the NATO-Russian Russia Commission, by the way, and Cyprus, tiny island nation, which is on its way to the Partnership for Peace military program of NATO, that every single European country is either a member of NATO or a member of one or more partnership programs with NATO, as long as that situation continues to obtain, there is no possibility of talking about the European Union having a foreign policy, surely not a military policy, independent of Washington and the Pentagon.
Rick, both Russia and NATO have a stake in the outcome of the insurrection in eastern Ukraine. If this conflict could be considered part of a broader geopolitical chess game between NATO and Russia, who would you say has the winning hand at the moment?
NATO. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just as simple as that. It's not as though Russia and a group of 27 military allies is ensconcing upon the United States at its borders and waging a 310-day war on the Canadian-American border with hostilities actually spilling over into the United States. If that were the situation, I'd say Russia had the advantage. But as the war is being fought out on Russia's border and frequently, incidentally, across the border into Russian territory, and as NATO is massively building up its military strength in what it routinely now calls the frontline states of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Bulgaria, and Romania, the first four border Russian territory, the second two face Russia immediately across the Black Sea. The encroachment by NATO, the U.S. military employing NATO for the most part, surrounding the Russia's western flank and increasingly its southern flank in countries like Georgia, certainly does not suggest that Russia has played a strong hand in this case. It is on the defensive. NATO is aggressive. It is the aggressor in this situation, and its plans for military buildup in Eastern Europe and the initial stages of that buildup predate the Ukrainian crisis by years, by decades. Ukraine was the first former Soviet republic outside of the Baltic states to be dragged into NATO's Partnership for Peace transitional program, the very one used to promote, develop, and graduate the 12 new members of NATO that entered the U.S.-dominated military bloc in the decade between 1999 and 2009. So that, it's a question, I suppose, how far the Russian political leadership is going to let this expansion and aggression go on before it acts, if it acts at all.
Barring a Russian surrender, do you see this conflict escalating into a nuclear conflict, or will the major powers find some way of climbing down from the brink?
I have never mentioned that possibility, though I did a year ago state that the crisis in Ukraine had the potential of bringing about a direct confrontation between the world's two major nuclear superpowers, and that was and remains the case. As I've had frequent occasion to mention, somewhat ironically, the person who has mentioned that just such a scenario at least twice in the past 2 months is someone who, in my estimate, is the meekest capitulator to U.S. demands, until recently in Russian history, Mikhail Gorbachev, who has twice warned, as I mentioned in recent weeks, about the possibility of a nuclear war should the crisis in Ukraine continue to exacerbate. So, I mean, that is a possibility. We can't dismiss it. I think we have to be careful, too, that there is the fear of nuclear war. I mean, there's no greater fear known to man, of course, and I'm not trying to diminish it in any way, but I think the threat of nuclear war can be exploited also as an excuse for inaction, particularly on the Russian side. And the argument that I'm sure most of your listeners have been subjected to, as I have repeatedly over the last year, is something along these lines, that if Russia does anything to defend its own border or its own territory or in any way stands up to NATO, then there's a risk of nuclear war. So Russia's saving the world from nuclear incineration by doing nothing. That's the argument. And, I've done a slight reductio ad absurdum to show where this is going. But I think whereas we have to be as cautious as anything in the world about even the most remote prospect of a nuclear exchange of nuclear weapons, nevertheless, I don't think that we should be awed by that threat into not realistically analyzing developments as they're occurring in the Ukraine.
Well, Rick Rozoff, we're grateful for this rather insightful analysis. I know you'll be continuing to watch the situation very closely. Thank you again for joining us on the Global Research NewsHour.
Thank you, Michael.
I've been speaking with Rick Rozoff, a geopolitical analyst and manager of the Stop NATO listserv. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.